Before I begin my words for tonight on the sutra, I just want to check in really just for a few words on our dramatic politics. And I was doing that pretty much every week for a while, but I stopped on purpose, not because I have stopped thinking about what's going on or paying attention to it. Probably you have also been paying attention, but I thought that sometimes we need a break, and I think the Dharma is a break. The Dharma is exactly that. It's a break from suffering. So I thought I don't need to be a broken record and talk about this all the time. It's good to take a break. It helps us from flying off the handle. It's so easy to fly off the handle. But let me just say that at this particular moment, there is so much emotion and imagination and fantasy in the politics right now. What I mean is that there are the things that happen, and then there are all the things that people say about what happens, and the back and the forth, and the agitation about what happens. Pretty soon it's hard to tell the difference. And the net effect is that people become quite frightened and upset, and maybe that's part of the... Some people would like that, would like people to be frightened and upset. It's a good thing for some people. So if we're watching what's going on in our country and in the world, things are still in process, and we don't really know exactly where all this is going. We don't know how drastic things will become. They're bad enough now, and I hope that very few of us, maybe I hope none of us, are directly impacted by what's going on, but many, many people are. I'm sure we're all connected, I know I am, to people whose lives have been directly impacted. So that's bad enough, but we don't know what the future holds. And since we don't entirely know, we have to pay attention to what's going on, but stay stable and wait for more clarity about what this amounts to and what, if anything, can be done. Anyway, I'm not telling you anything you haven't already thought. I just wanted to bring it up so that you could hear from me how I'm feeling, and just to know that this is certainly part of our study and part of what we're all thinking about every day. I don't want to go into it more because there's so many reams of words already about all of this. You don't really need more. So thank goodness for the Gandavyuha Sutra, which is a whole other world. Last week, we didn't meet to talk about the sutra because we had a ceremony. And in fact, there were two ceremonies last week that I participated in that reminded me of the sutra, that, given that I have been reading the sutra. The ceremonies echoed for me the sutra. Many of you attended last week's lay entrustment ceremony with Eva. And it was truly wonderful and inspiring. And it felt like the pure assembly of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, in which there was no room for anything at all but love and joy and enlightenment. It was a very uplifting moment. And I think we all of those who participated in it, kind of felt that. What a great break from the world that doesn't seem to feature those feelings all that much. And yet, as the sutra keeps saying, and as I've been saying every week, it is not really a different world. It is the same world. And we have to develop the eyes to see that it's the same world and not be inundated by the emotional power of the partial world that we, so many of us, live in. So we're working on that. That's what we're doing. We're working on seeing the world whole with eyes that really see. Anyway, the ceremony was that, you know, for a moment. And then a couple days later, Kathy and I and a bunch of our Dharma brothers and sisters climbed up the mountain to the stupa site at Tassajara, where we were interring the ashes of our dear teacher, Sojin. And the ceremony of ashes interment is powerful and solemn, as you can imagine. And one of the things that we do in the ceremony is we recite the Shari Raimon three times as we put the ashes into the earth. The Shari Raimon is the traditional statement of the honoring the relics of the Buddha. So as we put the ashes into the earth, we say this: with wholehearted reverence, we bow to the relics of the true body of the Tathagata Shakyamuni, who is fully endowed with myriad virtues, to the Dharma body, which is the fundamental ground, and to the stupa, which is the whole universe. With great reverence, we venerate the one who manifested a body for our sake. Through the sustaining power of the Buddha, which enters us even as we enter it, we verify awakening. By means of the Buddha's spiritual power, we benefit living beings, arouse the thought of enlightenment, cultivate bodhisattva practice, and together enter perfect peace, the knowledge of the equality of all things. And that statement could come directly from the, it doesn't, but it could come directly from the Avatamsaka Sutra. And it was my job in the ceremony to chant these words three times. And when I chanted them, I really felt it. I felt all of us standing there. We're really in a timeless realm of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. In the 50 years or so that I knew Amel and all the people assembled there who also had known him for many, many decades, all those years just flashed by before my eyes in a moment of time. And I was young and I was old, and all the archetypes of all the times of all the worlds were included in that. Poof! Everything gone in a flash, as if it had never been, and also not gone. And it felt like that, just for a flashing moment. And this is really what we're imagining and what we're experiencing every time we do any Buddhist service. You know, the priests go through a whole bunch of rituals to get to be in the place where they stand in front of the altar to imagine that world, to imagine that at the moment of addressing the altar and offering incense, we're offering to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are in the room. Just as we felt in the moment of interment that Sojin Roshi is the Buddha, and that these are the Buddha's ashes, so in every service we are imagining our purified Buddha field. Everybody in the room is a pure Buddha, a Bodhisattva. That's what we're embodying and imagining when we do those services. And it occurred to me, you know, in the Christian West, at one time, you know, go to an art gallery, you know, in Rome or Europe, and room after room after room, every painting that anybody did who could paint was a painting of the archetypes of Christianity. And that's what you saw hanging in every house, in every church. You saw them all the time. All the music you heard was music that came out of that archetype. And it was the same in Asia, where all the art and the music and the ritual for a millennium or so consisted only of depictions of the Avatamsaka Sutra and other Mahayana sutras, and they were painted on the temple walls. You saw them wherever you went. You went to visit monasteries, and there they were, and you felt the sacredness of them. And you probably, when you went to bed at night, you probably dreamed about them and thought about them, and they were images engraved on your minds, on your mind, uppermost in your mind, something that was just a part of what you were. And isn't it something to think that nowadays our minds are full of something else, right? There are very little images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in our minds, you know? We're practicing Buddhism, but there's not that many. We're reading the sutra, but even so, mostly what's in our minds are the whiplash of the daily news, the Netflix crime shows, and who killed who, and how did they do it, and, you know, the British are so good at this, they have so many great crime shows, and actors who played the detectives who were really good, and the pop music that's on in every building you go into, and all the stuff that you could buy, and because they know you want it, on your Facebook feed that they want to sell you because you once bought something like that. And there's a million of them. That's what my mind is full of. Much more than it's full of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, because I live in this world. So it's nice to put a few drops, anyway, of love and faith and enlightenment into my mind as I go on reading the sutra. So I think it's really good for us. It's a kind of antidote. So tonight we have some volunteer readers, and I have more stuff to fill in once they're done. We don't know how long they're going to take, or what they're going to read, so we'll see. But let's let them start us off. And so I know, Girija, you're going to read, right? So, yeah, so you can unmute yourself and tell us maybe where you're reading in the sutra, and then just go ahead and read what you wanted to read.
Yeah, I am reading about Vasanti, the Night Queen, and in my version it is starts on page 1285. There are two sections I'm going to read, and the reason I chose this was that even the image of the Night Queen brought to mind all these illustrations of childhood books and Egyptian goddesses of a mother who is a sky who's kind of enveloping all of us. So I was very taken with that. And also her qualities that very much reminded me of Way of the Bodhisattva. So the first paragraph is a description of who she was. She was beautiful with a golden complexion, soft, rich black hair and dark eyes. Her body was adorned with all sorts of ornaments, and she was wearing a red robe. She wore a sacred crest adorned with the orb of the moon, and her body showed reflections of all the stars and constellations. He also saw in her pores all the sentient beings who had been liberated her from the calamities of unfavorable circumstances, evil and miserable conditions. He also saw in her pores all the sentient beings whom she had settled in heaven and all whom she had perfected in the enlightenment of here and individual illuminates and omniscience. And I'm going to go to a second section where she is speaking. For those in the desert, in the darkness, by various means I comfort them, show them the way, and lead them to safety, resolving that by this root of goodness I shall liberate those who are in the desert of the mundane world, who have fallen into evil ways, freeing them from all suffering and setting them on the road of omniscience, where there is eternal safety. And for those in inhabited areas who are experiencing the trouble of owning a home, I draw them away from their attachment to their abodes by various means and resolved by this root of goodness to remove all sentient beings from attachment to the elements of body and mind and establish them in non-maligned omniscience. And for those who lose their sense of direction on a dark night, who think level ground is uneven, who think high ground is low, who think low ground is high, I light the way for them by various means. To those who want to go out, I show the door. To those who want to travel, I show the road. To those who want to cross over, I show the bridge. To those who want to go in, I show the house. And to those who want to look around, I show the directions. I show the high and low ground, the smooth and rough terrain, and its various formations. I show travelers the villages, cities, towns, provinces, and capitals. I show those who are hot and thirsty, streams and ponds and groves and parks. To those grieving at separation from their loved ones, I show their family and friends, advisors, acquaintances, and kin, in various pleasing forms. And I resolve that just as I light the way for those in the dark who cannot see and have lost their way, as I create light to make various forms manifest, in the same way, I will use the light of wisdom to destroy the darkness of ignorance of those in the long night of the mundane world.
Thank you. That was great. I actually noticed that passage myself. It caught my attention in the list of all the people who are suffering, the people who are suffering because they owned a home. That really struck me. All the suffering.
Yeah. Where she talks about how she will give them home.
Yeah.
Right. And I just want to say that the mundane world, the last phrase, not the mundane world, but world.
W-H-I-R-L, yeah,
which
right.
Which is really what we're talking about.
That's exactly what I was talking about. The mundane world, yeah. We're spun around, literally spinning. We're spinning, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for reading that. Beautiful. Let's see. Who else was going to read? Manny, are you? Manny's here. Yeah, Manny was going to read some too. There she is. Go ahead and unmute yourself, Manny, and read. I'm seeing Tommy, not Manny. There's Manny. Yeah, good. Hi, Tommy. So you're on mute, so you have to unmute yourself. There you go.
Sorry, I had two computers.
Oh. Yeah, you need to turn one off because there's a...
Okay.
Yeah, good. Okay.
There, I'm going to go over here. So I am reading about Vaira, the mariner, starting on 1261 on the PDF.
Okay.
And I chose that I was going to read something else, but I had a dream last night that I was swimming in the open ocean in very, very deep water, and there were swells, and I was very emotional, and I somehow made my way into a boat, and then I started crying. And when I woke up, I started reading where I left off, and this was... where I was. So I thought, all right, this is what I have to read. With these thoughts in mind, with a purpose rarely encountered, Sudhana made his way to Kuttikar city looking for the mariner, Vaira. When he got there, he saw the mariner surrounded by hundreds of thousands of merchants and hundreds of thousands of other people who wished to hear him talk, explaining to them the oceans of virtues of Buddhas by talking about the ocean. Vaira said, "It is good that you aspire to supreme perfect enlightenment and ask about the means of attaining great knowledge about the cause of the various miseries of the mundane world, about the means of arriving at the island of omniscience, about the means of producing the indestructible vehicle, universal salvation, about the means of attaining the path leading away from the danger of falling into the state of individual liberation, about the source of the path of knowledge, of the way to attain all kinds of tranquil concentrations, about the source of the unobstructed path of the chariot of vows carrying the practice of enlightening beings which goes everywhere, about the means of development and purification of the path guided by the nature of enlightening practice adorned with all waves of energy, about the means of development and purification of the endless path facing all things, the means of development and purification of the path into the ocean of omniscience. I live in this coastal metropolis of Kutagara, purifying enlightening practice characterized by great compassion. Observing those on this continent who are poor, I practice such spiritual exercises as will cause their wishes to be fulfilled. I will take care of their mundane needs. I will satisfy them with spiritual enjoyments. I will teach them the way to accumulate virtue. I will foster knowledge in them. I will promote the growth of the power of the roots of goodness. I will inspire them to seek enlightenment. I will purify their aspiration for enlightenment. I will firmly establish their power of great compassion. I will get them to extinguish the misery of the mundane world. I will firmly establish their power to act in the mundane world without tiring, and I will get them to care for all living beings. I will set them at the gate of entry into the ocean of virtue. I will produce in them the light of knowledge of the ocean of truths. I will turn them toward the ocean of all Buddhas, and I will plunge them into the ocean of omniscience. With these thoughts in mind, I roam this city on the edge of the ocean, thus committed to the welfare and happiness of the world. I know all the treasure islands in the ocean. I know all the deposits of precious substances, all types of precious substances, and all the sources of precious substances. I know how to refine, bore out, extract, and produce all precious substances. And I know all precious vessels, tools, and objects, and the light of all precious substances. I know the abodes of all water spirits, the agitations of all water spirits, the abodes of all sprites, the agitation of all sprites, the abodes of all goblins, how to alleviate the danger of goblins, the abodes of all ghosts, and how to put an end to obstacles caused by ghosts. I know how to avoid all the whirlpools and billows, and I know the colors and depths of all the waters. I know the cycles of the sun, moon, stars, and planets, and the lengths of the days and nights. I know when to travel and when not to. I know when it is safe and when it is dangerous. I know the performance and soundness of the hull and rigging of ships. I know how to control and steer ships. I know how to catch the wind. I know where the winds rise from and how to direct the ship and how to turn it around. I know when to anchor and when to sail. With this knowledge, always engaged in working for the benefit of beings, with a sturdy ship, safe, peaceful, without anxiety, I convey merchants to the treasure islands of their choice, pleasing them with spiritual conversation. Having enriched them with all kinds of jewels, I bring them back to this continent, and I have never lost a single ship. All who see me or hear my spiritual instruction are freed from all fears of sinking in the ocean of the mundane world. They become aware of the knowledge of how to go into the ocean of omniscience. They learn how to evaporate the ocean of craving. They are illuminated with knowledge of the ocean of past, present, and future. They become capable of annihilating the ocean of suffering of all sentient beings. They undertake to clear the turbidity of the ocean of minds of all sentient beings. They begin the heroic effort to purify the ocean of all lands. They never turn back from going throughout the ocean of all places. They penetrate the variety in the ocean of faculties of all sentient beings. They adapt to the ocean of actions of all sentient beings, and they appear in the ocean of the world intentionally according to the mental set. I have attained this enlightening liberation, which is characterized by great compassion and the sound of flowing water, and it is beneficial to see me, hear me, live with me, and remember my name.
Wonderful. Thank you. That is a great one. Yes, and then where you ended, the next thing that happens is the same. It's this stock thing that happens at the end of each of the spiritual benefactor, as they say. And I know this that I just told you, but I don't know the following. And then they explain what they don't know, and that Sudhana should go to the next spiritual benefactor to find that out. And
that's go on your way.
Yeah. And that Sudhana goes there. But yes, I guess, you know, in going on ocean vessels was, people did that to exotic places, and it was a dangerous thing. And ocean vessels could easily not return. So this was someone who always brought his ship in, you know, because he really knew how to do that.
Never lost a single ship.
So bodhisattvas are, you know, skillful. They're not just pie in the sky. You know, they know how to do stuff, right? And they know how to help people out with real skills. You know, they know. So this guy knows a lot of stuff, yeah. So that's beautiful. Thank you. Beautifully read. Let's see. Judith, are you here? You were going to read too. Judith Gilbert.
Hi.
Yeah, there you are.
Yes,
good.
I'm here.
Great.
So I did the picking by opening the book up and going like
mm-hmm.
that. So.
Bibliomancy, yeah.
So this is a little earlier than the Gandavyuha. It's mm-hmm. the Ten Abodes chapter. I think it's 15 or 16.
Mm-hmm. So this is in the Avatamsaka Sutra, one of the earlier chapters
yes.
that we're not reading,
yes.
but it's before all this. Yeah, good.
Yeah, and so it kind of echoes Sudhana's first 10 stops, I think. So, the abodes of enlightening beings I shall now explain. Buddha children, there are 10 kinds of abodes of enlightening beings, which the past, future, and present Buddhas have explained, will explain, and do explain. What are the 10? They are the abode of initial determination, the abode of preparing the ground, the abode of practice action, the abode of noble birth, the abode of fulfillment of skill and means, the abode of the correct state of mind, the abode of non-regression, the abode of youthful nature, the abode of prince of the teaching, the abode of coronation. These are called the 10 abodes of enlightening beings, expounded by the Buddhas of past, future, and present. What is the enlightening being's abode of initial determination? And these are mapped exactly through the 10. The enlightening beings, seeing the magnificence of the Buddhas, which people like to see, rarely encountered, having great power, or seeing their spiritual powers, or hearing predilections of enlightenment, or listening to their teachings and instructions, or seeing sentient beings suffering great pain, or hearing the far-reaching teaching of enlightenment of the Buddhas, develop the determination for enlightenment to seek omniscience. The enlightening beings arouse determination with 10 difficult-to-attain objectives. The knowledge of what is so and what is not, the knowledge of the consequences of good and bad actions, knowledge of superiority and inferiority of faculties, knowledge of the differences of various understandings, knowledge of the differences of various realms, knowledge where all paths lead, knowledge of all meditations, liberations, and concentrations, knowledge of past lives, clairvoyance, knowledge of the universal end of indulgence for all time. Here the enlightening being should encourage and study 10 things, diligently making offerings to the Buddha, gladly remaining in the world, guiding worldly people to reject evil deeds, always carrying on instructions by means of the most sublime teaching, praising the unexcelled teaching, learning the virtues of Buddhahood, being born in the presence of Buddhas, and always being received into their company, expediently expounding tranquil concentrations, enrolling detachment from the cycle of birth and death, being a refuge for suffering beings. What is the reason? To cause enlightening beings' minds to broaden in the Buddha's teaching and to be able to understand whatever teaching they hear without depending on another's instruction.
Wonderful.
That was the first abode.
Yeah, that's great. Yes, you get the impression from all of this that this is really about making our lives bigger, right? This is very, very big. This is, and part of the inspiration for that, as you just read, is that not only are you, because in that list there was both the inspiration to see the Buddhas and how great they were, but there was also the suffering of the world that was dismaying. So we start maybe with an awareness of suffering, our own suffering and the suffering of the world, but then we open out to this vast place in which this very life is the life of all the Buddhas and all the dimensions, and we're not only in one location, we're in every location, and we're not only saving the person in front of us, we're serving everyone at the same time. So it's a kind of a wonderful kind of opening up of the closing down that our minds can do of our lives. So great, thank you. Those were the only ones that I'm aware of. Now, is somebody else going to read that I don't know about? We ask people, it's on the website that you can, and I'm going to encourage anybody who would like to read next time and or the time after that to choose a passage and read. And you can email through the website and we'll develop a list so we know who's reading. So am I right that those are the only readers for tonight? Looks like it. Okay. So I want to share a few passages, just take a few more minutes before we go into groups. I wanted to say that, as we've said before, the pagination in the online text is different from the one that I've got, because the paper version has the Gandavyuha as a separate text, so it starts in the, on page one, sort of, whereas the version that you see online has the Gandavyuha in the context of the Avatamsaka Sutra, so the pagination it starts around page 1100 or something like that. But in general, what I've done, I mean, we're not obviously covering the entire sutra week by week by week, but more or less what I'm doing myself is dividing, counting up the number of weeks that we're doing this sutra, starting in August the 6th, I think we began, and then dividing those weeks into about 30 or so pages a week, which is a lot of pages to read in this very dense, right, reading. It's hard to read 30 pages. You couldn't do it in one sitting. You have to do it over several sittings. So that gives you an idea about where we're at. You can do the math and figure out it's week 7 or week 8 where we're at. So that doesn't matter that much, as you see people are reading from all over the sutra. And if you want to choose a passage, it could be from anywhere. But just so you know, I'm sort of roughly following that plan and trying to read to the end of the sutra by the end of next month, when we're going to be stopping this series. So I'm going to read a little bit, just introduce a little bit about a nun called Sinavaji Jambita, who in the paper text is on page 141. So that tells you it's about 140 or so pages into the from the beginning of the sutra. And she lives in a place called Sunset Park, which sounds like a nice place. And in the park, Sudana, when he goes to see her, in the park he sees trees called moon risen, which were covered like pavilions of flame-like color and blazing radiance, lighting up the space of a league all around. He also saw leafy trees called completely covering, which are shaped like parasols, their clustered leaves providing shade, shining like blue crystal clouds. and that describes and goes on to describe all the many kinds of trees, and for some reason or another, the various trees and fragrances and all the things that are there have names, and each one of them is described. And at the foot of these trees was jeweled lion seats, many of them adorned in various ways. And the ground of the whole park was scattered with various jewels, just as the ocean is scattered with jewel islands. And the earth was studded with blue lapis lazuli and inlaid with all kinds of jewels. It was soft and pleasant to the touch and would give way and spring back when one walked on it. And then after the long description of the scene there, it says, the final sentence is, Sudana saw this sunlight park by the strength of the mystic power of the nun Sinavajijumbita. So it was her projection. The whole world of the sutra is a projection. This world that we live in, called the Saha world, is also a projection, but it includes the feature of stickiness or attachment. So it feels a little different, but it's also a projection. So this whole world that he saw was her projection. Now, there were lots of lion seats, and here's the thing that's interesting. In all of those lion seats, in every one of them, under the various precious trees, he saw this nun, Sinavajijumbita, sitting. So there were many of her, many versions of her all over the place, on all these lion thrones. And she was under each throne, surrounded by a great company of followers, calm, composed, her senses and mind quiet, well controlled, her senses subdued, as restrained as an elephant, her mind pellucid and clear as a deep pool. So this is the kind of archetypal image is of a Buddha. And in this case, it's a nun in the shape of a Buddha sitting on a lion throne, surrounded by a pure assembly of listeners, and all the peace and love flowing between them as the Dharma is preached. And everywhere you look, there's another one of these assemblies. So that classic assembly is the archetype of the sutra, repeated over and over again. And then I'm skipping a couple of pages. So she's tells you about all the different kinds of people who are there and their attainments. And Sudana is watching all this. Thus he saw the mature, the teachable, the capable among those in all states of being gathered in this park, each type in a separate assembly. So there's a separate Buddha assembly for each type of person, with various inclinations and interests, firmly intent and deeply faithful, with the nun Sinavajijumbita teaching them each in such a way that all became certain of supreme perfect enlightenment. How was that so? Because the nun Sinavajijumbita had gone into countless tens of hundreds of thousands of doors of transcendent wisdom, beginning with the equanimity of the universal I, exposition of all Buddha's teachings, differentiation of the planes of the reality realm, dispersing all obstructions. So he then prostrated himself before her. And I don't know which one of her he did, because there were lots of her. So I don't know. It doesn't say that he did this to every one of her, but he did this to her, it says. And then circled her with respect hundreds of thousands of times. So he's walking around her, which is the sign of respect, you know, to circumambulate with your bare shoulder toward the person of honor. But he did this hundreds of thousands of times. And that's when the whole park and the congregations were suffused with a glorious light from the sun. And she said, and this is also something that appears with every one of the benefactors, they say, this is the teaching that I have attained, that I stand for, that I'm teaching. Sometimes, frankly, for me, it's hard to tell the difference between them. They have different names, but it's pretty hard to tell the difference. But anyway, the name of her attainment is, I have attained the enlightening liberation of removal of all vain imaginings. It is the light of knowledge whose nature is instantaneous awareness of phenomena of past, present, and future. It was kind of like, now that I'm reading this, it reminds me of what I said in the beginning about how I really did feel like in a moment there, it was actually after I was offering incense at the altar and turning around, and I saw Kathy, who at that moment was also offering incense, and it reminded, I saw Kathy, she was in her, she was 22 or something, which is around when I met her. She was exactly 22, and all the time in between, you know, vanished. And so, because time is a kind of, we make it up in some way, right? So that's the light of, that's the knowledge that, that this nun had, whose nature is instantaneous awareness of the phenomena of past, present, and future, all in an instant. But what are the vain imaginings? And this is what the vain imaginings are. She says a little later on, I see all beings with the eye of knowledge. Yet I do not conceive any notion of sentient being, and I do not imagine so. I hear all beings' verbal signals, yet I do not imagine so because I do not enter into the spheres of any discourses. I see all Buddhas, yet I do not imagine so because I know that their body is reality. I remember the cycles of teachings of all Buddhas, but I do not imagine so because I am aware of the true nature of things. So vain imaginings is the world of being caught in any attachment. And the only way you're caught in attachment is if you think there is something to attach to. But she sees that there is nothing to attach to. She has no imagine. You only can attach to something you have imagined. So this world that we live in is literally imagined. Our brains have made it, right? We know that our brains are making people and objects and things that we name and believe to be separate from ourselves, and therefore we have issues with them. But that's vain imaginings. She doesn't have any vain imaginings. She just appreciates everything and doesn't imagine that it is anything at all. She knows that it's there only as a phantom. Anyway, that's her. Then some pages down the road, our favorite Avalokiteshvara appears. So Avalokiteshvara is one of our benefactors, one of the teachers. And she, or in this case, Avalokiteshvara is appears as a male. He's on a plateau on the west side of the mountain, which was adorned with springs, ponds, and streams, sitting wakefully on a diamond boulder in a clearing in the large woods, surrounded by a group of enlightening beings seated on various jewel rocks, to whom he was expounding a doctrine called Light of the Medium of Great Love and Compassion. So in this sutra, you know, every single one of these bodhisattvas is motivated by love and compassion. It's hard to tell the difference between any of them and Avalokiteshvara, but as we know, Avalokiteshvara is most known for this love and compassion. The whole sutra is bathed in the light of love and compassion. So her enlightening practice is called Undertaking Great Compassion Without Delay, which sets about impartially guiding all sentient beings to perfection, dedicated to protecting and guiding sentient beings by communicating knowledge to them through all media. That means not only words, but visual objects, just by the sound of the voice, all kinds of ways of communicating. Established in this method of enlightening practice, undertaking great compassion without delay, I appear in the midst of the activities of all sentient beings without leaving the presence of all Buddhas. So the nature of all activity among all sentient beings is compassion. Avalokiteshvara is there because anything that is done, really, when you think about it, any action that is done fundamentally for others. Everything is done for others. If one of the others is also yourself, so if you make lunch and eat it, it's an action that you're giving compassionately to this sentient being known as you. So all activity is inherently compassionate. And Avalokiteshvara is in all activity. That's what he just said. And take care of them by means of generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and cooperation. And this we've mentioned before. These are the four methods of guidance of bodhisattvas that appears now and again throughout the sutra. I don't know that there's any rhyme and reason to why it appears or where it appears, but this is my favorite fascicle of Dogen that I really recommend that you read. It's in the earliest translation that many of you have, Moon in the Dewdrop, that early book that was came out in the 80s. One of the ones that we translated was Moon in the Dewdrop was the Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance. It's one of Dogen's most inspiring and poetic texts. And he talks about these four: generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and cooperation. Or the way Kaz translates that one is identity action. And the idea is that bodhisattvas practice these four things so that they can inspire others to emulate them and want to practice themselves. So just the same way that bodhisattvas are influenced when they see Buddhas, and they're really inspired by Buddhas, and they want to be like the Buddhas, and they want to aspire to Buddhahood because they see the Buddhas. So bodhisattvas are supposed to behave in the world in such a way that sentient beings, without trying to, you know, be manipulative or strategic, just they behave this way. And then seeing them behave this way, sentient beings are inspired to themselves aspire to goodness and full enlightenment and omniscience and this vast cosmic project of being a living being. So that's what Avalokiteshvara practices, and she or he is vows to be a refuge for all sentient beings, to free them from fears of calamity, threat, confusion, bondage, attacks on their lives, insufficiency by means to support life, inability to make a living. So many people nowadays are scared. You know, there's a lot of talk about economic suffering. You know, people don't have enough money. They're afraid. You know, they won't have a place to live. People are really. That's a terrible kind of suffering that Avalokiteshvara completely recognizes, and so she wants to be a refuge for people who have the inability, fear of the inability to make a living. Fear of ill repute, the perils of life, intimidation by the crowd, death, miserable conditions, unknown hardships, servitude, separation from loved ones, living with the uncongenial, physical violence, mental violence, sorrow, and depression. Avalokiteshvara is there to receive all of these kinds of suffering and to be a source of refuge. So this is the thing that, you know, we're trying to actually do this, right? So that's why we can't afford to be swept up, right, by the turmoil of the world, because our commitment is to be refuges, right, for people who are swept up in the turmoil of the world. So it's very important that we maintain stability and a kind of mind that knows what's going on and definitely sees the suffering and has sympathy for the suffering, but we are not spun around in it, because if we were, how could we be a refuge to people? And being a refuge doesn't necessarily mean doing anything in particular other than being there and willing to be there and hold the hand of someone who is swept around in what we noticed is called the mundane world, the mundane spin. It's interesting that that's the exact word they use when they talk about the crazy news. They say spin, right? That's exactly what the news does. It spins. They're spinning the news, right? Spinning the news is spinning everybody. And that's the mundane world. But we have to be a refuge for sentient beings caught up in the mundane world. Okay, let's see. One more quick thing, and then we'll stop. There's a giant, Mahadeva, who is really huge body, and Sudhana goes to him, and he says, "Noble one, I have set my mind the usual question," and then celestial Mahadeva extends four hands in four directions. He is in a temple at the crossroads of the city, not near the ocean. However, he's so huge that he extends four hands in four directions, and he brings water from the oceans in all the four directions with extreme speed, and he washes his face and scatters golden flowers over Sudhana. And his teaching and his method is that for those who are intoxicated with the enjoyment of objects of desire, who are very greedy for enjoyment of objects, I make the objects seem impure and undesirable. To those filled with anger, those who are arrogant, conceited, proud, and haughty, those who should be led away from strife, I show terrors like fiends and ghouls who feed on flesh and blood, and show them that is all the vehemence of arrogance. So then they get turned away from their arrogance and their anger. To those who are lazy and negligent, I show the dangers of fire, water, kings, and brigands, to stir them to vigor and diligence. And so on and so on. The next one is benefactor number 30. So on this text, page 159, which means about 150 pages or so into the text, we're already on teacher 30 of 59. And this one, Stavira, is an earth goddess. And it begins a whole bunch of teachers who are now located at the seat of enlightenment. The teachers that he's been visiting are all over the place. These teachers are all somehow right close to the place where the Buddha was awakened, which is sort of an infinite physical space. And then after this earth goddess come a whole set of what are called night goddesses. And the text, when it comes to the night goddesses, takes on a slightly different tone, because the visit to each teacher, and there are nine of them, or eight of them, from 31 to 39, each one of these teachers has a very long story, because at the end of them expounding all that they know and do, Sudhana says to them, "And how long did it take you to get like this?" Something that he has not asked the others. But he asked these night goddesses, "How long did it take you to get like this?" And then the night goddesses go into these elaborate stories, page after page after page of quotation, until you forget who's talking and what's going on. And they're telling about their past lives and how they served these Buddhas and did these things. And then, as a result, we're reborn as night goddesses. So that part of the text is has a different shape and a different tone. Okay, so that's enough from me. I encourage those of you who are at all interested to read, to email the website and read next time or the time after that. Next week we're in person, right? So keep that in mind if you're going to read. So I think we have time to do groups of three, just with each person with a three-minute take, a quick take. And so here's what I'm suggesting that you speak about. I've been talking this way for quite a long time. I don't even remember when I started talking about how spiritual practice is inherently a practice of the imagination, as are all the arts. The imagination that is a cognizing organ of the human being, not just fantasy and fooling around, but reality. Imagination accesses reality. So spiritual practice strengthens our imaginative capacity to see beyond the one-dimensional world we think we're living in. And this imagination makes us more humane and more able to live in and withstand the difficulties of the world and be a refuge, as we were just saying. So how are you doing with that idea? What at this point in time, what do you make of that idea? Does it make sense to you? Is reading the sutra helping you to see that, or is it maybe making you confused? And if beyond that, has this thought and this teaching had any impact on your sitting practice, I wonder? So how has this teaching of the imagination, as evidenced in the sutra, affected you? How do you see it, if you do? And has it affected your sitting practice? So as always, you're free to take this wherever you want to take it or talk about something else that's important on your mind, but that's my suggestion. So in short order, we'll get into groups and we'll be back in about maybe around 10 to 12 minutes. Thank you, everybody, for reading and for listening to the sutra. We'll see you in a little while.